a reminder of what we did last time. But let me first remind you where, and maybe me as well, where we are. So we're in the process of proving the following theorem. If omega is a bounded Lipschitz domain in the plane, if gamma 1 and gamma 2 are two conductivities in with two derivatives in LP, this, by the way, makes them continuous. So if they're positive, they're bounded below. Are such that the corresponding Dirichlet to Neumann maps are the same, then gamma 1 is identical to gamma 2. So this proof will take us a while. One thing we did is we, so this is the Dirichlet to Neumann map for the divergence form equation, divergence gamma grad u is zero. And so the first thing we did is we said, let u equal gamma to the minus a half w. And that leads to a Schrödinger equation for w with potential Laplace gamma to the 1 half over gamma to the 1 half. So we're in the process of constructing exponentially growing solutions for this. And so Q, by assumption, you can check Q is in LP. So we want to construct solutions of the form e to the I x zeta, let's call them phi, then we extend q to be identically zero outside omega. And I, as I explained last time, we now look in all of R2 so we want solutions psi x zeta of minus Laplace plus q psi is 0 in all of R2. With psi behaving like e to the I x zeta for x going to infinity. So here zeta, as we discussed, satisfies, so is in C2, satisfies zeta 1 squared plus zeta 2 squared equals 0. So if zeta 1 is a complex number k, we can think of zeta as k, ik, or k minus ik. And then e to the I x zeta just becomes e to the I k x1 plus I x2. So that's e to the I k z. So we write psi of x z, k. We abuse notation a little bit. Forget about zeta. We now look at k. Good morning. We write psi as e to the I kz times a function mu. And if we substitute this into the Schrödinger equation, we get, oh, I should have done that with zeta first. So we had the conjugated Laplacian which in terms of k we can write as 4 d bar d, let's see, zeta dot grad is k ik dot dx1 dx2. So that's k dx1 plus I dx2, which is twice k d bar. So that's minus 4 times I k d bar plus q mu equals 0. Okay. So for the first 2 hour of hour or two today, here q mu, mu, yes. So the object is to construct these mu's. And so in preparation for that, so we're taking advantage of the fact that the conjugated Laplacian in 2D is factors and so we'd like to construct its inverse. So we'd like to construct d plus ik inverse d bar inverse. All right. So d bar inverse, okay, let me remind you, d bar of f at z inverse, sorry, is the Cauchy integral f of w conjugation by 1 over z. And I'll write d2w for DW real, DW imaginary, just the Lebesgue measure on the plane. And we saw last time that by the basic Hardy-Littlewood-Sobolev theorem on fractional integration, D bar inverse takes LP to LP tilde. It's basically convolution with something in weak L2. It's also easy to then construct D plus IK inverse. We did that as indicated on the second line, where I introduced that useful little notation, EKZ, Z to the IKZ plus K bar Z bar. So that's a reminder from last time. So the problem becomes when you combine these two, D bar inverse takes LP to LP tilde, and now we need an estimate from LP tilde, which is bigger than 2. And so that's not covered by the first inequality. What we did instead is we noticed that if we let G be D bar inverse F, then indeed G is in LP tilde. In other words, it has less decay than the sort of function you'd like to apply D bar inverse with, to. However, D of G, right, it has less decay, but it's also a little smoother than your typical function. D of G is in fact D bar inverse F, and since the Björling transform is bounded on LP, this will be in LP. And so we are placed in the conditions of the lemma. We have a function g which is in LP tilde. dg is in LP. On such functions, we can define a new d plus ik inverse. So this was inspired by the resolvent formula, and we checked that this indeed satisfies that equation. And now the advantage here is that this is the old D plus IK inverse, which takes LP to LP tilde. The advantage is that it's being applied to DG, which is in fact in LP. Okay, so this lemma you can think of is a new D plus IK inverse. So D plus IK inverse when applied to such gadgets. And then these estimates follow immediately. So if you put these two together, we get a lemma about this operator. So this operator is the inverse of the constant coefficient part of the equation we're interested in. Okay? Once I write down this lemma, we'll then look at constructing solutions to the variable coefficient one by solving an integral equation. And so the plan for today is construction of exponentially growing solutions in 2D. So definition of the scattering transform and to motivate this we'll do two formal calculations. Good morning. Two formal calculations. So on the one hand, I will show you quickly the asymptotics, large X asymptotics of a mu. And then I hope to have time, maybe the last hour, to give you a sketch of how inverse scattering the basic idea of the Gelfand, Levitan, Marchenko business in 1D. For this plus, it's not the same Q. Let's call it, I don't know, V for potential. And this should if you saw my lecture on Sunday, we were talking about taking the derivative of mu in k bar with respect to k bar, which will be the key to the inverse problem. Well, so I wanted to motivate that. Why? Where does that come from? And the answer is it comes from Dick Beals, who's sitting right there. It's lucky for me that I prepared this little 1D sketch. And so the idea, so this is just the standard sort of Gelfand, Levitan, Marchenko. And the specialists always like to argue what they should call that. but the idea of interpreting this, Beals and Koifman, to think of it as a D-bar problem in K. So it was a lovely idea that created jobs for a number of people. myself included. Okay, so that's the plan for today. So let's put the results from last time together in a lemma for this. I don't know if I should number my lemmas. This one should be 3 by now. Yeah? Okay. So for any F in LP, and any, now there is a little price you pay here in this lemma, namely that K has to be non-zero to be able to use this trick. And so we'll only construct things for K non-zero, and part of the proof, I don't know whether we'll go into it or not, then requires a special hard work to make sure things are okay for K near zero. So for right now, let's say for any zeta in C2 minus zero with zeta squared equals zero, there is a unique U in LP tilde. So this is of R2, satisfying minus Laplace minus 2i zeta dot grad u equals f in all of R2, and moreover u has one derivative in LP tilde, so at first you might say, well, this is a second order operator, you should have two derivatives, okay? But if you, as we discussed last time, here we traded one of the derivatives for dk already. So u is in W1p tilde, and u Sobolev 1p tilde, 1, sorry, sp tilde, constant over zeta to the 1 minus s, for zeta constant bigger than zero, and s between zero and one. So this isn't really very hard or exciting. The more exciting part will be when we start looking at the variable coefficient operator. We're basically are finished with this, so let's quickly put the proof together. So as noted, may assume zeta is kik, k different from zero, k is a complex number. And then we need to solve minus 4 d bar d plus ik u equals f. Okay, so we I let you, so part of the homework is uniqueness with an exercise. I did prove uniqueness for you for the first order operators. And similar ideas you can use here. And so I need to show existence. So for existence, we simply let u equal minus 1 over 4 ik. So I apply this, which is at d plus ik inverse, to d bar inverse. So I have d bar inverse minus d plus ik inverse d bar inverse of f. So then you check, as we did last time, then d bar u equals 1 minus 1 over 4 ik f minus. So let's see, d plus ik inverse is e minus k d inverse ek. So d bar of that d bar e minus k, if you look up there, it's just minus I z, k bar. Is minus I k bar, sorry, plus e minus k d bar d inverse e k. What am I doing? Well, it's just four jumps. So this is I want to show, yeah, maybe it's easier to do the d plus ik first. So d plus iku, this we did last time, but okay, let's do it again. Minus 1 over 4 ik d plus ik d bar inverse f minus d Well, we checked that d plus ik of this is d d bar inverse f. Ah, right. So this is equal to d d bar inverse f minus d d bar inverse f. That's that cancels, and so we have minus ik over 4ik d bar inverse f. So that's minus a quarter d bar inverse f. So d bar d plus iku is minus a quarter f. Which is what we need. And now the when s is zero, the s is zero, the LP tilde norm of U is less than or equal to constant over k LP norm of d bar inverse f plus LP norm of d bar inverse f, and both of these, possibly with a new constant, are less than the LP norm of f. On the other hand, the gradient of U, LP tilde, is less than a constant times d, d bar inverse f, LP, and that too is less than a constant times LP. So if you bound k away from zero, you have both of these bounded by, so now you're throwing away some information. If k is bounded away from zero, and now we have one estimate for LP tilde with a 1 over k, and an estimate, a uniform in k estimate for W1P tilde. Using interpolation for Sobolev spaces, you then get this estimate with s between 0 and 1. So when s is 0, this is 1. When s is 1, this disappears. So that's it. It's just putting together what we already had. Questions? All right. How do we solve this problem? Well, we want, so now comes a little motivation. We want psi to be like e to the I z k as z goes to infinity, i.e., if you factor out e to the I to the k mu, to be like one as z goes to infinity. And up to now, I haven't made precise what I meant by u is like one. In what sense? Now, armed with this nice little lemma, we make this more precisely. Will require that mu minus 1 should be in LP tilde. So it goes to 0 as the function LP tilde would. So let's call this equation star. So let's write mu equals 1 plus mu tilde temporarily. Then star becomes minus 4 d bar d plus ik d bar mu tilde plus q plus q mu tilde equals 0. And so what we can do is we can take both of these and throw them on the other side. Now, since mu tilde, actually, let's see. Instead of LP tilde, let me make my life easy during motivation and say W1P tilde as we have here. So since mu tilde will be in W1P tilde, by Sobolev embedding, it's bounded. Let me remind you over here. That if you have a function with s derivatives in LR, of Rn, this function is bounded, in fact, it's in C alpha, where alpha is S minus, so assume S is bigger than R over N. So in this case, so for us, n equals 2, s equals 1, and 1 over p tilde is n over r, right? Getting mixed up with my. Yeah, of course. So 1 over p tilde is 1 over p minus a half. So 2 over p tilde is 2 over p minus 1, which means s minus 2 over p tilde is 1 minus 2 over p plus 1. And that's bigger than 0. Did I count that right? Yeah, since p is bigger than 1. Okay. So W1 p tilde is contained in continuous functions, bounded continuous functions. So if you multiply this by Q, we'll have a function in LP. So look at this equation and compare with what the lemma 3 says. We're precisely in the situation with lemma 3. We have thrown all the variable coefficients on the right side for the moment. And so we'll have that mu tilde is the inverse of this, we'll have to give this a name, by assumption. The theorem we started proving had conductivity in W2p. Q takes two derivatives off of that, and so it's in LP. That's the assumption. Okay, so this is equal to this applied to Q minus same operator applied to Q mu tilde. So this is an explicit gadget which we have, and so this is becomes an integral equation in mu tilde. And the integral equation takes place in this space, W1 p tilde. So it then will be an exercise to show that, in fact, this is a Fredholm integral equation. I'll remind you what that means. And because of this estimate, for k sufficiently large, in fact, you don't need Fredholm, for k sufficiently large, we will get a unique solution to this integral equation, no problem, the moment we have this estimate, because this operator will have norm less than less than 1, and so we can just use a Neumann series. So in dimensions 3 and higher, we would be done. Basically, there you only need to construct solutions of this for large zeta. Okay, we haven't discussed the estimates in dimensions 3 and higher. We'll come to those. But if we had something like this, we would be essentially finished. We would have a solution which not only does exist for large zeta, but goes to 0 as zeta goes to infinity. Put that in the integration by parts we saw at the beginning and we'd be finished. Finished proving the uniqueness in the Calderon problem. So, I mean, if you sort of forgot that, we'll get back to it when we go back to 3D. But all I'm trying to point out is the problem in dimensions 3 and higher, as I mentioned, is overdetermined. In some sense, we have too much data. And that shows up in the proof in that we only use the large zeta solutions of this for large zeta. And that's somehow enough. In two dimensions, the problem is formally determined. And so intuitively, well, people had tried, before I started thinking about this, people had tried solving the problem with just large k, and that seems to not give enough information. So the issue is, can we construct solutions of this or of that, not just for large k, but for every k? So most of the work in our second hour will be to show that, in fact, the null space for this integral equation is trivial for any k. Precisely, well, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. But for the Q's, which are of this form, we'll show this is uniquely solved. Now, it turns out, once you have the whole machinery of the inverse problem in place, you can prove that conversely, if this equation is uniquely solvable for every K, then in fact, Q must be of this form. So that was, in some sense, my lucky break, that for the problem of interest, for the Calderon problem, that was precisely the case for which this equation turns out to be uniquely solvable with no singularities in K. All right, so see you in 10 minutes. certainly that's not something reasonable to assume here, right? The solutions here should look like e to the izk. However, here, the condition that h e to the minus izk is in LP tilde is so we just need the real part of the exponential. The complex part of the exponential doesn't matter in this condition. Let's just say minus zk imaginary. Okay, so this is the same as the real part of h e to the minus zk quantity imaginary is in LP tilde and the imaginary part of k. What about derivative? Ah, you caught me. So what about derivative? Well, what we're saying is the gradient of h e to the minus izk should be in LP tilde. That means grad h e to the minus izk should be in minus. All right, now what is this? So we're back to, it's easier to think of this as e to the minus I x dot zeta. So the gradient is minus zeta. So this is minus I K I K H e to the minus I Z K. Okay, so the issue is this. Suppose I can prove that if H is real valued and satisfies this, then h must be 0. Okay? Now, assume h, maybe we should write this down. So here's the proof of note. In fact, maybe first I should you know what, let's do it this way so that we keep it clean. Proof of proposition, first assume h is real valued. Okay, I'll prove it for that, and then I claim I can reduce to that case. We then define v to be this. Then V is in LP tilde. And D bar V equals that. Okay. Now, I claim we know something about this term and that term. They should cancel. D bar dh is a quarter Laplace h. Laplace h is qh. And d bar d psi naught is a quarter Laplace psi naught. That's a quarter q psi naught. So psi naught d bar dh minus h d bar d psi naught is 0. Now, I'd like to express dh back in terms of v. So dh psi naught is v times e to the izk. Plus h d psi naught. Now here's where I will use h as real valued. Since h is real valued, dh conjugate is d bar of h. So d bar h, psi naught is also real valued. So taking conjugates, we get v bar e to the minus I z bar k bar plus h d bar psi naught. So substitute this in double star. So substitute the above in double star. And we find that d bar v equals well, I need d bar psi naught times the top. So v d bar psi naught e to the izk. Over psi naught, right? Put it like this, this times v. Times the, okay. And then so d bar psi naught times this plus h d bar psi naught d psi naught over h. So now I've done this term and I'm moving on to the minus sign term minus v bar over psi naught times d psi naught e to the minus I z bar k bar thank you minus h d psi naught d bar psi naught over h. All that multiplied by e to the minus izk. So this is nice enough to cancel with that. And we're left with d bar v equals d bar psi naught over psi naught v, the exponentials cancel, minus d psi naught over psi naught. Now we have e to the minus I z bar k bar, e to the minus I z k, that's my little e to the minus k, times v bar. Okay, so what have I achieved? I have started with a solution of a second order problem, the h up there. I've taken this particular clever combination of first order operator applied to h. And I show that that combination satisfies a first order problem. So another way to think of this is that this lemma shows that the second order operator in H can be reduced to a first order system. Something of this. Okay? Now, and by the way, this idea of reducing it to a first order system was then used in Brown and Ullman to work directly on this first order system, which, as you see, only involves first derivatives of essentially gamma, and so extend this business to conductivities with one derivative in P, LP with P bigger than 2. Back to the proof. So a little educational aside. A function v which satisfies d bar v is av plus bv bar is called pseudo analytic. Of course, if a and b are zero, this is an analytic function. So this is a class of functions that was studied quite energetically in the last century, in the maybe even first half of the last century, by people like Lippmann-Boers, who was competing with Vekua. And others. And there's a beautiful theory of such functions, paralleling that of analytic functions. So you can think of this as analytic functions with variable coefficients. Cauchy-Riemann with variable coefficients. In particular, there's a Liouville theorem, which is what we need here. So what's usually done in this, so I guess it's easier to see if I do it on this, is you define W to be D bar inverse of A plus B V bar over V. Now, so V bar over V is by definition 1 if V equals 0. So we're not worried about when this vanishes. Then look at V bar of V E to the minus W. Well, it's D bar V, which is AV plus BV bar E to the minus W. I think this trick is due to Carleman, by the way. So that precedes Vekua and Bers. You see it's a beautiful little trick. Plus, or you could just say, well, it's not, everybody could have done this. It's just an integrating factor for this equation. Because look what happens. So I've done d bar v. Now I have to do d bar of the exponential. So that's going to be v times, let's say, do it slowly, minus d bar w. So that's av plus bv bar minus d bar w, which is a plus b . So it's 0. So that means that V e to the minus W is actually analytic. So a pseudo-analytic function is equal to an analytic function times an exponential. Okay? So let's do this here. Let's see how many stars am I up to. I think this should be triple star for today. No. Functions of z. Z bar. C infinity functions, let's say. D bar V is AV plus BV bar, right? Plus D bar W. And D bar W, by construction, so this is some function, some other function, take D bar inverse, the operator we know. D bar of that is A plus B V bar. Multiply that by V. So it works for variable coefficients. Now, of course, W is not explicit. You don't know. If you don't know V, you don't know W. So if you use this to actually solve for V, you would you know, it would be a nonlinear equation. Okay, so using this on triple star, we define W to be D bar inverse of D bar psi naught over psi naught minus D bar psi naught over, oops, one is D and one is D bar, D psi naught over psi naught E minus K V bar over V. Well, and you may well ask, if this is an LP function, or LP tilde function, what do I mean by e to the to this function? Okay, and for that I need a little lemma. So I'll put this on the side so as not to disrupt your train of thought. Claim D bar psi naught over psi naught minus D psi naught over psi naught E minus K D bar over V is in LP intersect LP tilde. And lemma, D bar inverse. If a function is not just in LP, but it's both in an LP space with P less than 2 and in one with P bigger than 2, as is the case in my claim, then this is bounded, it's contained in L infinity intersect continuous. Actually also vanishing at infinity. So let me just check the claim, and then we'll put the lemma aside for a little later, okay? This is very elementary. So what I'm saying is D bar inverse of a function is in some sense nicer than what we had up to now, if the function is reasonable. Okay, let's just check that this is in fact a reasonable function. D bar psi naught, by assumption, is in LP, and by, so this is assumption, and it's in LP tilde by Sobolev embedding, as we've discussed. Same with this. It's in LP, but its derivative is Q, which is also in LP, therefore this is in W1P. Sorry, W1P. And by Sobolev embedding, that's also, that's in LP tilde. And this is bounded, and this is bounded. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for reminding me. So, D psi naught is LP by assumption and is also in W1P since Laplace psi naught is Q psi naught is in LP. Hence, d psi naught is in LP intersect LP tilde. Since W1P by Sobolev is embedded in LP tilde. Okay? So you can forget about my little scribbles up here. So that's in LP intersect LP tilde. That's in LP intersect LP tilde. This is bounded, and this is bounded. So by lemma, oh my God, what number is it? Four. By lemma four, W is bounded and continuous. Hence, V e to the minus W makes sense. Right? Point-wise, I know how to exponentiate a number, so I know how to exponentiate a continuous function. It makes sense, and it's analytic. Is analytic. And moreover, since W is bounded, this is bounded. Thank you for asking. V is in LP tilde. And in LP tilde. By the Liouville theorem from last time, V is identically zero. We're not done. What does it mean that V is zero? Thus, psi naught dH minus H d psi naught is zero. So that means d of h over psi naught is zero by the quotient rule. Right, psi naught is bounded away from zero, no problem. H over psi naught is in L P tilde and anti, whoops, no, it isn't. H over psi naught is anti holomorphic. That's what this says. Now, what do I know about H? H itself is not in LP tilde, but H times some monster exponential is in XP tilde. So let's look at H e to the minus I z bar k bar. This is anti-holomorphic. Because H is, and this has a Z bar in it, and it's equal to H E minus I Z K. Oh no, maybe I want E to the plus. E to the plus IZK, E to the plus IZ bar K bar. Right? I'm allowed to write this. It's a free country. This is in LP tilde by assumption. And this is bounded by 1. It's e to a real, purely imaginary. So it's anti-holomorphic and in LP tilde. Hence, again by Liouville's theorem, Liouville's theorem from last time, H is identically 0. All right, so that was the crucial lemma. I'm thinking that this was a bit technical and maybe I should change the subject. Or should I go on? I know. I want to leave the note for next time rather than suffer through it in front of you. We improve the uniqueness. So we could finish off the theorem. Maybe we should finish off the theorem. And I'll change the subject next time. All right. So, proof of theorem. So, maybe we should call this theorem 2. It's only an ingredient in the main theorem that we have. Okay. So we need to solve, we've shown uniqueness. for existence, write mu equals 1 minus I plus mk q inverse applied to mk q. So mk, I remind you, where is mk? It should be down here. Takes LP to W1 P tilde. Okay, so I want to solve this equation. So I claim I plus mk q is invertible in W1 P tilde. Well, first note that it bounds one, I mean, W1 P tilde is contained in L infinity, Q, so QW1 P tilde takes so MKQ takes W1 P tilde into LP times bounded. MK then back takes it back to 1 P tilde. Well, you take a function. I mean, you think of this as an operator. You don't need a dot if you don't want a dot. Take a function in W1 P tilde, multiply it by Q, puts it in LP, then this puts it back in W1 P tilde. Yes, in W1 P tilde. So here an exercise. For the interested reader, show MKQ is in fact a compact operator. So this is typical. MK, right? MK is basically a Fourier multiplier. I mean, this is a fancy way to write it, but remember, it's basically multiplying on the Fourier transform side by something like this. Q is a multiplication operator in space. Product of such things tends to be compact. But I've given you most of what you need here to show that it's a compact operator. In fact, I'll sort of say it in words. If this were a bounded domain, right, then Sobolev embedding would be a compact operator. That's Relich's lemma or something like that. right? So you can put this in a slightly smaller Sobolev space that's compact, and that itself then stays in L infinity. Now, we're in infinite space, but the limit of compact operators is compact. So you write your infinite Q as a limit of ones that are compactly supported. Okay, so this is a compact operator. Identity plus compact, I plus MKQ, is therefore Fredholm. Is thus a Fredholm operator of index 0. That means the codimension of its range equals, right, the index is the codimension of the range minus the dimension of the null space. So if the index is 0, it means codimension of the range has the dimension of the null space. Or put in less fancy terms, just like a matrix, right? If it's injective, it's invertible. So identity plus compact behaves like a matrix. That's all you need to know. And I claim we've already shown the null space is trivial. If I plus MKQ H is 0, that means H is minus MKQ H. Which means minus Laplacian minus 4ikd h. Ah, h is not a good one. H tilde. Equals or plus. Okay, equals minus QH tilde. Let H equal H tilde E to the plus IZK. And here I should say, if this is true and H tilde is in W1P tilde, well, if H tilde satisfies the conjugated Laplacian, H is just going to satisfy Schrödinger. And H e to the minus IZK will be in W1P tilde. So by the proposition, H is identically 0. This is not a surprise, right? I mean, the fact that the null space of this operator corresponds to null solutions of the problem we're interested in. That's all I'm saying. thus the null space of I plus mk q is trivial. Therefore, well, put it this way. Thus, I plus MKQ is injective on W1P tilde. Therefore, also invertible. So if Q is in LP, this is in W1, Q in LP, MKQ is in W1P tilde, and this makes sense. And mu is well defined. So what did we do? We wanted to solve a differential equation with constant with variable coefficients, which is once you factor out this exponential, looks like that. We use the Green's function for this operator, or if you wish, the inverse of this operator, to write this as an integral equation. We prove the integral equation corresponds to a Fredholm operator, and the main work was to prove the injectivity of that operator. And it's therefore invertible. Now, how does mu inherit? After all, the how does mu inherit the estimates that we had for the constant coefficient operator? After all, when you work in W1P tilde, there is no decay. When S is 1, this does not go to 0. So what do we do? So it remains to, maybe I should stop because you all look exhausted. I'm only starting, but you've run out of steam. So it remains to check the note. And the large K estimate. Existence and uniqueness of mu.
In
W1P tilde. So there's this little subtlety here, which is not very important, but I better stop.